Okay, so let's start by discussing some motivation for why it's worthwhile to learn quantum mechanics in great detail. So let me just say that, okay, we're gonna say quantum, and I'm gonna write quantum, you know, many, many times, so it just becomes a Q for simplicity. So this is quantum theory and general relativity. Are the two fundamental dynamical theories of modern physics. So notice that I emphasize dynamical here. So one of the things you want to keep in your kind of conceptual framework is that once we learn quantum mechanics, we still need other physics to describe physical systems with quantum mechanics. So what is that other physics we need to input? Sorry? A Hamiltonian. And what does the Hamiltonian encode? I can't hear you, I'm sorry. Yeah, in the sense of the physics, the forces, expressed through an energy function. So in addition to our dynamical theory, we need to input a specification of the forces at play, and that comes from the laws of electromagnetism or gravity, the weak and strong nuclear forces. So that, combined with our dynamical theory, gives us an ability to describe, predict, and control physical systems. So we have to supplement quantum theory with laws about physical forces. So that's an important piece, because one of the things I've been working very hard to achieve is a clean axiomatic formulation of quantum mechanics, so that when we're solving a problem, we can just appeal to those axioms and understand that we have a sufficient set of axioms to do that. But of course, the axioms won't include, you know, the physical laws. That's an additional piece you have to input. A lot of the situations we want to describe, like a quantum dot, we have effective forces anyways, which, you know, deriving them from first principles would be impossible because the system is so complex. And so we just put in some model for the physical forces based on experimental input. And that's the case for many physical systems today that are relevant to quantum technology. So this is a practical point. Another point of motivation is that we need to understand how to unify quantum mechanics with general relativity. This is the primary research interest of many of the faculty here at Perimeter Institute and around the world. This is probably the deepest and hardest theoretical problem facing modern physics today. And it's my personal view, everyone has an opinion about the right way to do this, it's my personal view that we won't see the right way forward on this problem until we've achieved a better conceptual understanding of quantum theory. So I feel like we've kind of swept under the rug some conceptual issues that seemed metaphysical or impractical in order to apply quantum mechanics to describe superconductivity and PN junctions and things like that. But we have to return to those fundamental questions, those conceptual problems, to get a better grasp of what quantum theory is telling us about the world, in order to see the right way forward and how to unify it with general relativity. So not everyone will agree with me. Some people think we've already found the right way forward. It's string theory. Other people think we found the right way forward and it's loop quantum gravity. And I have a different view. Okay. So quantum theory, another reason for studying quantum theory is a purely practical one, which is that it is probably the most accurate scientific theory ever devised. I guess I haven't looked carefully into the precision with which we can test general relativity by GPS experiments and so on. But the precision with which we've tested quantum mechanics is extraordinary. Phenomena have been tested to one part in a billion and confirmed between theory and experiment. So quantum theory is probably the most accurate theory ever tested. So we have an example I wrote in here, which is the fine structure constant. So the experimental measurement of the fine structure constant is 137.035.99070. I'm sorry if you can't see this. With the last two digits, I guess 98 is the uncertainty on that, which agrees with theory, with the theoretical prediction for one part in 10 to the 8. Okay, so it's an extraordinarily accurate theory. In addition, quantum theory is I'll say one of the most practical theories ever devised. So by this I mean, you know, like thermodynamics and like classical mechanics, quantum mechanics actually describes an enormous variety of physical phenomena within a single theoretical structure. We believe that it describes all phenomena, but we know for sure that it describes well atomic scale and mesoscopic scale phenomena. So a broad variety of useful physical phenomena. Are predicted or described by quantum theory. So what do we mean by useful? So some examples, for example, the PN junction, which is the basis for modern circuitry. A solid state phenomena described by quantum mechanics based on the energy gaps and so on. What else do we have? We have lasers. We have superconductivity. Nuclear power. Medical imaging. Such as functional MRI and other methods. So these all have an enormous impact on society. They're important technological developments which require quantum mechanics for their description. So we have this theory which has three important features. One, it's fundamental. We believe it to be a fundamental description of the world. You know, when we combine it with quantum, with general relativity, we don't know what's going to have to give, what's going to have to change. But very few people think that quantum mechanics needs to change. It's enormously accurate. It's enormously practical. in addition to being of fundamental relevance. So that's a very nice situation. So there's lots of different reasons to come to the theory. And I'll add to this quantum technology, quantum information technology, as a more modern development. And that's something I work on, and maybe we'll touch on it at the end of the class. So also, another reason is, I guess my bullet points are different here. Let me number these. So a fifth point I wanted to make is that there are deep kind of metaphysical questions which are along the lines of what is quantum mechanics telling us about the nature of reality? So here we have issues like non-locality, the question of making sense of superposition and tunneling, the no-cloning theorem. How do we make sense of these things? What does it tell us about the physical world? And it's also my belief when I mentioned that we need the right conceptual understanding of quantum mechanics to move forward on this deep question. I think that tackling some of these issues and at least understanding what we don't know or what we've been misled to think is a key step, at least to kind of open your minds to the fact that the way you think about quantum mechanics might not be the right way to think about it at a conceptual or metaphysical level. And there are lots of perspectives on this, and I think it's good to keep an open mind in the different ways of thinking about quantum mechanics give different insights that help us solve different kinds of problems. Okay. So I think I'll end the motivation there, but are there any questions or other motivations you feel should be mentioned? Yes.
The part three thing with the bind sort of problem. Which theory? Because as far as I know, there's no pure polarization of the quantum
stuff. I'm sorry?
The alpha, which is likely 1.37 point blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
So agrees with theory, but as far as I know, there's no theoretical derivation of this fine source of function.
Okay, so you're pushing my recollection here, but I think it's calculated through a quantum field theory perturbative. You have to calculate all kinds of Feynman diagrams up to whatever order you can manage. And the theoretical precision is only limited by the computational problem of computing higher and higher order corrections in the quantum using quantum field theory, or QED. Is that different from what you think? I thought it's a constant. It doesn't have energy dependence.
Yeah, okay. I'll
look at it. Oh, yeah. Well, maybe double check your sources and come talk to me. But if not this, then there are other examples of things that have been measured to high precision. And then one other thing I wanted to mention, I guess maybe I'll mention that in my postulates, but where do I say that again? Okay, good. I'll say that later. Okay, great. So let's get started on the postulates of quantum mechanics. So it's in order, right? Left to right, is that how it works? Well, you want the rear to go up. We'll bring the front. Okay, so as I mentioned, I'm going to try to express quantum mechanics as a set of postulates. And this is actually a non-trivial task. So it turns out that there's a lot of nuance, and we'll address some of that nuance as we go. So take this as provisional. It's not a usual approach. People usually just kind of, you know, regurgitate all the things you need to know about quantum mechanics and don't distinguish kind of what's a postulate versus what's a derived fact and things like that. Why is it useful to think about it in terms of postulates? Well, obviously, it's good to have a concise formulation. Secondly, one of the interesting problems that, for example, was pioneered, considering this problem was pioneered by Lucy and Hardy here at Brimmer Institute, it's to ask the question, how come we don't have a better physical understanding of the postulates of quantum mechanics? So I'm going to give you the postulates. The postulates are going to be, we describe preparations of systems with Hilbert space vectors. We describe measurement with self-adjoint operators. We describe transformations with unitary operators. These are all very mathematically abstract statements. They're kind of pulled out of a hat. We know they work. We know they give us a structure we can use to predict systems. But where do they come from? So contrast that with special relativity, where one takes physical principles, like the speed of light is constant in all reference frames, as a starting point to derive the Lorentz transformations. Right? So you have a nice physical principle that gives you the mathematical formulation of the theory. In the case of quantum mechanics, we don't have that. We just start with these mathematical statements. So that's been an area of pretty intense investigation over the last decade, where a variety of people have tried to put forward physical principles that imply the mathematical postulates of quantum mechanics. And what's interesting is that the set of mathematical postulates they derive don't always match, which points to the fact that we're not even clear on what we need as postulates to describe quantum mechanics. So the kinds of issues that come up are, for example, when we describe composite quantum systems, we're going to use a tensor product structure. Is that a postulate, or can we derive that from something else? In particular, we've mentioned already that quantum mechanics is a dynamical theory, and we have to supplement quantum mechanics with other physical information to encode, for example, the Hamiltonian. So somehow we have, on the one hand, quantum theory, and then we have, on the other hand, all this physical information, which is derived through which is driven empirically, like, for example, discovering the laws of electromagnetism. And we combine those two things to make practical predictions. So one of the subtleties is the tensor product structure. Well, is that implied by the other physics? Or do we take it as a postulate of the quantum mechanical description? So that's a subtle issue. Another issue is the state update rule. We're going to learn, how do we describe a quantum system after a measurement? This is the collapse of the wave function. Is that something, first of all, what does that even mean? What's its conceptual meaning? And we'll discuss that. And second of all, is that something that we need as a postulate, or can we derive that from other considerations? So that's something we'll address carefully. So as you can see, this isn't just a simple regurgitation of pedagogy here, giving you the postulates. This is kind of an active research issue to understand the right way to formulate quantum mechanics in terms of postulates. So this is my approach, and hopefully it will bear the test of time, but we'll see. So postulate one is, before I give you postulate one, let me also say one other point, which is that I divide up the postulates into ideal postulates and realistic postulates. So the ideal postulates describe kind of textbook quantum mechanics, which is very different from what you see in the lab. So we're going to go through these kind of idealized formulation of quantum mechanics, which is a very theoretical structure, and then we'll discuss what generalizations of that do we need to describe real-world experiments. So the ideal postulates. Postulate one. An ideal preparation procedure is described by a Hilbert space vector. Called a pure state. All right, so I've underlined these words because I want to highlight before we unpack the mathematical structure, which should be pretty basic stuff. Let me talk about what these words convey. So preparation procedure. Because of the metaphysical confusions about how to make sense of quantum mechanics, what does the quantum state mean and all that, it's best to just avoid the term quantum state because it has certain connotations which create a certain way of thinking which is hard to relinquish once you let it take hold. So what we're going to focus on is kind of an operational description . Okay, so the operational description, we're just going to focus on describing things we can do in the lab . Okay, so what we have in the lab is we have a box and it's going to have a button. This is the go button, and then we have a dial on the box, and that dial, there's some spectrum of settings on the dial. So this is a knob that I can adjust. And then when I adjust the knob first, and then two, I press the go button, and then something invisible comes out. All right, that's all we know. So what I'm describing with a Hilbert space vector is this procedure. I'm not saying there's some physical wave function or there's an electron or any of that stuff. Okay, just forget all of that. Just I'm describing this procedure via a mathematical object. And it turns out that the mathematical object I need is a Hilbert space vector to represent this procedure. Okay, so that's why I say preparation procedure. That's also why I say describe by, because we're in the business of describing things. We're not saying that the physical system that comes out of the box is a quantum state. How many of you see the distinction between the statement, the physical system that comes out of the box is a quantum state, and the statement, a Hilbert space vector describes this preparation procedure? Okay, the former sentence imposes a metaphysical meaning to this object which we need not impose. It's purely optional. And once you make that choice, it becomes hard to forget that you've made that choice of thinking about quantum states as physical objects. So let's not do that, because it turns out it's not necessary. It's an interpretational issue and probably an incorrect one. Okay? So now let's do some of the mathematical structure. Any questions about the conceptual framework? So I hope that most of this is review. So I'll go through it very quickly. So a Hilbert space is an inner product space. That is complete in the norm. Okay, so I assume you know what an inner product space is, so I won't review that. I assume you know what an inner product is, so I won't review that. Complete in the norm is probably new to some of you. How many of you know what complete in the norm means? Okay, not all of you. Is it something you covered? Okay, so let's just understand what that is. So first, let me say that all finite dimensional inner product spaces are complete in the norm automatically, are, I guess, I don't need to say automatically. So if we're talking about a finite dimensional system, we don't even need to worry about it. For infinite dimensions, we do need to worry about it. Oh, I see. Okay, so for infinite dimensions, for infinite dimensional inner product spaces, we require that all vectors obtained as the limit of Cauchy convergent sequences are elements of the space. Okay, this is one of those places where I need to find the right balance in terms of background and in terms of mathematical rigor. Okay, so for non-relativistic quantum mechanics, this is something you don't really have to worry about in practice. It's just a structural effect, like the way you want the complex numbers to be complete. So you want the limits of all elements to be included in the set. So you have nice mathematical properties. So understanding kind of deeply what this condition means is not extremely practical. It can be relevant. Some people who do quantum cosmology and such look at more general structures than traditional Hilbert space. And so you have to know about these kinds of subtleties if you go into that field. But it's not broadly relevant. And the other thing I don't know is for the notion of Cauchy convergent is for something that you know or should know because you saw it in your undergrad. So how many of you are comfortable with the notion of Cauchy convergent? Okay, the majority. Okay, so for those of you who aren't, I just suggest to review that, and we'll move on from there. Okay, so we're going to use Dirac notation, which I assume many of you are familiar with. So here we use this notation to denote an inner product, psi phi. There's lots of notations for inner product. Okay, so we talk about psi, which is equal to psi dagger, is an element of the dual space. So the dual space is the space of linear functionals on the Hilbert space. So linear functional is something, let's call it f psi. This is some map that takes an element of the Hilbert space to a complex number. Okay, so a linear functional is just something that takes as input a vector in the Hilbert space and gives you as output a complex number, or an element of the field more generally. And so it turns out by Rietz's theorem, for Hilbert spaces, we know that these two things are in one-to-one correspondence. So every element of the dual space has a unique counterpart as a linear functional. So the elements of the dual space are in one-to-one correspondence with the inner products. So in particular, we have F psi is in one-to-one correspondence with psi, which means that F psi acting on some input phi is equal to psi phi for every phi in H and for every psi in the dual Hilbert space. Let me move this up so you can see it. So we don't need to talk about linear functionals, we can just talk about these inner products because they're the same thing. And that's not true for all spaces, just for the Hilbert spaces we deal with. Okay, and so here this notation, sorry, that's a little bit sloppy. So H dagger is the dual space to H, which is the Hilbert space. And so the Dirac bra is an element of this dual space, and the ket is an element of the Hilbert space. And I should also mention, in terms of notation, I'm not making some subtle distinction of fonts. So phi and phi are equivalent. Okay, I noticed that I somehow like writing both of those and just use them interchangeably, but they mean the same thing. So I think one is like a cursive and the other is non-cursive or something. Okay? This mathematical structure is pretty good. You're all good with that? Okay, it's easy, it's pretty standard material and it's easy to review. Okay, so recall, and I'm not going to be able to show you this until we talk about measurements, but recall that all vectors in H that differ by a U1 phase e to the I phi are physically equivalent . Okay, so what this means is that psi is equivalent to e to the I phi psi for every phi in 0 to 2 pi. Okay, so here the bracket means we include 0, and the parenthesis means we don't include the endpoint because it's redundant with 0. And for all psi in H. Okay, so we have this. Who remembers why that's the case? I'm sorry? Same norm. I don't think that's strong enough. Not same inner product. They're different. They differ by a phase. Okay, so remember the lesson here. Let's focus on operational properties. So when we focus on operational properties, we're interested in what? We're interested only in the knobs we can adjust, the buttons we can press, and the pointer position readouts we're going to get later. Okay, so we're interested in what we can observe. So I haven't discussed the postulate for observation yet, but you've all had quantum mechanics. You know that observables are described by self-adjoint operators, which we'll get to in a minute. The quantum expectation value, an observable, we have psi A. Psi is the only thing that's empirically relevant, is the only mathematical object in the theory that we can directly compare with data. Okay, so we want to focus on what we actually know versus what we hope to think about quantum mechanics. So what we actually know is we can compare this object to data. And in this object, if I put a phase factor on psi here, I get e to the minus I phi in the dual vector. All right, so what that means is this is equivalent to psi e to the minus I phi, because here I get a minus sign because it's a dual vector. This is where you have to review the properties of inner product. A e to the I phi psi, and this is of course equal to e to the minus I, e to the plus I phi minus phi, which is 0, which gives 1 psi a psi. Sorry, this is bad blackboard technique here. Right, so this is just going to give us 1. This is just equal to 1. Okay, so if we change the state by a phase, all the observable quantities are invariant. In short, observable quantities are invariant. Under change of global phase. Okay, relative phase is physically significant, global phase is not. Okay, so example, we construct some quantum state that we write as alpha 0 plus beta 1. Okay, we can write this equivalently as, so here alpha and beta are complex numbers. This is equivalent to A0 plus e to the I chi B1, where now A and B are real, as is chi. Chi is also real. Chi is an element of 0 to 2 pi, which is a subset of the reals. So here, this object here, this is a relative phase. Okay, so the relative phase is physically observable. Now if I measure, just to give a forward reference, if I measure the Pauli Z operator, then are you going to be able to see chi? Don't be shy. No, okay? Because it's diagonal, the phase will cancel out. What do you need to do to see chi? What do you need to measure to see chi? Yeah, sigma x or sigma y. All right, so sigma z, you won't see chi, but there exist other observables where you will see chi. But now if I multiply this overall wave function by a global phase, e to the I phi, then what I'm doing is I'm multiplying both terms in the sum by e to the I phi, and that will have no effect. So we call e to the I phi a global phase, and then we call this a relative phase. So it's important. So the global phase is not physically significant, the relative phase is very important. Okay, so just as an advance notice, so for reasons, it will be convenient to describe preparation procedures by the projector . Okay, so let me just get you comfortable with my shorthand notation. So when you're writing an outer product of this form, normally you would write it as element of the Hilbert space, element of the dual space. This is called an outer product in general. When the element of the dual space is the dual to the element here, so instead of having psi phi, I have psi psi, this is a projector, which is a special case of an outer product. Now, my shorthand notation is just to draw it this way because it's a lot quicker. Okay, so I just make an X here. So please get used to seeing this and understanding it as that. Really, there should be a little space there, but this is my laziness. All right, so I can write faster. I guess it's not laziness, it's efficiency. But anyways, I hope it doesn't throw you off. Because in the past, I've given the whole lecture and a student came up to me, what's that X you're putting between psi and psi? So I've learned from that mistake, and I'm giving you that warning. All right, so that means this. This is notation. Okay, and I'm using this symbol here, rho, to represent that. We call this a density operator. And this is the density operator, a density operator associated with an ideal preparation is a projector. So when we later on want to compare quantum mechanics to classical mechanics, it turns out we get a much cleaner comparison if we work with the density operator, which includes ideal preparations as a special case. That's the first motivation. Second motivation is it's mathematically cleaner because notice how the global phase will cancel out. If I try and change psi, you know, call this, define this to be psi prime, then you have that psi prime is equal to e to the I phi psi minus I phi, which is just equal to psi psi. Okay, so we remove the global phase via using this formulation. And the third reason for this is that when we want to describe realistic preparations, we never achieve, in practice, the ideal of preparing a pure state. We always prepare something called a mixed state. And this formulation allows us to use the same mathematical object to describe both ideal pure states and mixed states. And so here, so that's another reason. So there's lots of reasons for doing this. We won't adopt this notation until a few lectures from now, but I'm just giving you a forward reference. So just remark that rho is not an element of the Hilbert space. Rho is a linear operator on the Hilbert space. Acting on the Hilbert space. So what that means is that rho is an element of LH. Okay, that's an important distinction. When we come to it later, just bear that in mind. So in particular, well, I'll discuss that later. So it's going to be a positive operator on the Hilbert space. Okay, more mathematical structure. So sorry, this is a little bit... there's a lot of just mathematical structure here. It's not necessarily very conceptually important. Okay, so for infinite dimensional systems, so this is dimensional, we only require what are called separable Hilbert spaces. Okay, how many of you know what separable means in this context? Only 2.5, okay. So a separable Hilbert space, okay, so this means that all orthonormal, here ON here is orthonormal, bases are countable. Okay? Countably infinite. Yeah, maybe I'll say that. Okay, what does countably infinite mean? So what this means is for any psi element of H, I can write psi is equal to a sum over L from 0 to infinity CL AL. So this includes H can be an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Where AL is an orthonormal basis. So notice when I say, okay, countably infinite means I have a sum instead of an integral. Is an orthonormal basis for H. All right, I won't write any lower because it's hard to see. We're out of room, so I'll go over here. So contrast this. Contrast with the momentum eigenstates. Which I'll call K. And then we can write these out in the position representation as e to the I kx. And then in wave mechanics, so this is what you learn in undergrad, I can write any psi as an integral over dk, some function ck e to the I kx, where this goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay? Yeah?
Like a particle in a box, mm-hmm. right? In a finite box.
Yeah.
Then couldn't you have like a discrete spectrum in here and a non-discrete spectrum outside?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a very good question. In fact, forget that out. I mean, just talking about a real atom, you have the it can be the electron can be ejected from the hydrogen atom. So we need a continuous spectrum to describe the free states, and yet we need the discrete spectrum to describe the bound states. So what's going on?
You can have two Hilbert spaces that you consider. One of them.
No.
No.
Okay, so this is new to you guys. No one here knows this. Okay, so you've been lied to is what's going on. So it turns out that the momentum eigenstates are not Hilbert space vectors. They don't belong to any Hilbert space. So we'll review in a moment the properties of Hilbert space, and we'll see that these functions do not satisfy the properties of Hilbert space, properties of Hilbert space vectors. In particular, they're not normalizable, which someone hinted at earlier. And Hilbert space vectors have to be normalizable. So what we do is, when we do wave mechanics, we use this as a mathematical trick. It's something that is not rigorously justified in the Hilbert space picture, but it's convenient. So whenever we talk about a plane wave of specific momentum, we're using that as a proxy for a Gaussian wave packet with an arbitrarily narrow variance in momentum. And it's just mathematically more convenient to just write this down than deal with the subtleties of an overcomplete and non-orthonormal basis of coherent states, which are these Gaussian states. So we're going to touch on that. Now, that's a topic that it runs very deep. There's a lot of subtleties. It's in the notes, which I will distribute to you. And the question of how deeply we cover that in class is a question of how interested you are in these kind of mathematical nuances, which for all practical purposes don't really matter that much. All right, so you have to make that judgment call about how much you care about mathematical rigor and how much you care about expediency. There was a question somewhere. So it depends which way. You mean the eigenstates of position, the Dirac delta functions? The answer is no. But you can write down a set of physical wave functions. So let's think about the harmonic oscillator. So the eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator are some Hermite polynomials. So we can write down any wave function for the harmonic oscillator as a sum of this form where we're using Hermite polynomials, where the ALs are the Hermite polynomials, which are an orthonormal basis for our Hilbert space. But we also want to describe it in terms of position eigenstates with Dirac delta functions. And then we have the continuous set of Dirac delta functions where the, you know, delta x minus x prime, the x prime can be any position on the real line, and so it's a continuous infinity as opposed to a countable infinity. So it turns out the Dirac delta functions are also not elements of the Hilbert space, just like the momentum. And this is because of the fact that the position and momentum operators are self-adjoint operators, depending on the domain, but they're unbounded operators. Their spectrum has no bound. And for these reasons, there are a bunch of mathematical subtleties about how to handle those special operators, which play such a fundamental role in classical physics and a fundamental role in our way of grasping how to describe systems, what's its position, what's its momentum. But the mathematical treatment of them within the Hilbert space formulation is actually very subtle. And so you can get away with the techniques you learn in wave mechanics because they're self-consistent, but they're not somehow rigorous. And so I guess in a few lectures we'll decide how deeply we want to go down that rabbit hole. But that's just to give you a heads up that it turns out we only need separable Hilbert spaces, which means we're excluding position and momentum eigenfunctions, and we can be self-consistent and do that by dealing with things in a certain rigorous way. Yeah.
So there exists a separate Hilbert space that contains all the solutions of the free particle?
When you say solutions of the free particle, that's too vague. If you mean solutions to the eigenequation for position, which are the Dirac delta functions, then no, they're not included. They serve as a proxy for a Gaussian wave packet, which is arbitrarily narrow in position. So it's kind of a shorthand substitute. And then in wave mechanics, you learn these rules about how to expand in terms of them. And they're really just a shorthand calculus. And there's a much deeper mathematical machinery that you need to do things rigorously. But in practice, it doesn't matter that much. So that's where we'll have to make that judgment call in a few days. Was there another question in the back?
Yeah, can't you just see the free case is like the limit of like harmonic oscillator and just expand this way and then take limits again?
Well, that sounds fairly similar to what I was saying about thinking of these as limits of Gaussian wave packets. But the point is, you don't just want to describe the harmonic oscillator. There's a huge spectrum of problems you want to describe with infinite dimensional Hilbert space, and we have to deal with all of those in one fell swoop. Okay. Maybe this is a good place to stop, and I guess tomorrow we'll start. I'll give you some examples of Hilbert spaces, and we'll discuss the infinite dimensional case a little bit more, and then we'll talk about measurement. Okay, thanks for your attention and your questions.